from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll find out about the upcoming Peacemakers concert.
I'll talk with Mark Zalonis about his long tenure as the IMA's Deputy Director of Environmental Affairs and Historic Preservation.
And I'll talk with author Pete Ferry about his book, Old Heart. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra will present Peacemakers, a work by ICO composer-in-residence James Aikman, on April 15th at the Schrott Center for the Arts at Butler. A signature project of Indiana's Bicentennial Commission, Peacemakers also has deep ties to Indiana. Travis DiNicola spoke to Aikman and ICO maestro Matthew Kramer to find out more.
James, Matthew, welcome both of you gentlemen. Thanks for being here on Art of the Matter.
Pleasure to join you, Travis.
Thank you for having us.
You are very welcome. This sounds like an amazing concert. I know you've been working on a long time. It's more than just a concert. Lots of different elements to it. Let's first jump into, though, how did this come about with the ICO working with you as a composer in residence to create this piece?
Well,
James?
Yeah, it's been around for quite a while in my thinking. In fact, back in 2010, I was on a walk up in Lake Michigan, and there's a good place for thought up there. It's a beautiful, secluded sort of beachfront that, I shouldn't be telling everybody. It's just gorgeous up there. Anyway,
we won't give the directions.
Yeah. You can find it on a map if you really look. Anyway, I was walking along, and this concept of peacemakers losing their lives in pursuit of peace really struck me, and I started thinking, why is that? And rather than focus on that aspect of it, I thought, let's keep these great ideas alive and focus on, their contributions and, this time in our society and also in history. It seems like the world's looking at us like we're a circus, and we need somehow to find a camaraderie, a way to come together in a positive way. And so that was the initial driving force of the piece. And it seems to get more and more timely as time goes by.
And then how did the ICO get involved with this?
This has actually been the culmination of a couple years of work. James is our magnificent composer in residence and has written works for the Chamber Orchestra before, including Triptych, which appeared on the ICO's first published CD. But I can say that I first came in contact with James and his music through my audition over a year ago for music director of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. When three finalists were selected, it was decided that James, while he was working on this project, would submit three separate movements for each of the conducting candidates to utilize or to perform during their audition concert. So as I was number three in January, I got a work entitled Peacemakers number three. And it wasn't until I was well within the studying process that I actually found out that my particular movement was a reflection of Anwar Sadat before his wonderful speech before the Israeli Knesset. So that's how I came in contact with it. And this was all a part, again, of a long process to bring this work to the stage. And now it's hard to believe that over two years of process here is finally fulfilling itself next week.
That's excellent. There's a lot of, I'm sure, excitement with that. Of course, the concert's part of the Butler whole arts festival going on as well, which is great. Perfect time to premiere this. There's also, of course, a lot of Indiana connections going back with both of you and the concert itself. But it's really a broader, more global work. Looking at the list of the different peacemakers who are being represented in this. And you know, just mentioning that today is the, as we're recording this, the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, he is in there. You mentioned Sadat, Gandhi, so many great people from the 20th century. And tell me a little bit about, I mean, how you selected each one of them.
Well, initially with Gandhi, since he was sort of the conduit, most of these great peacemakers somehow have been influenced by him. And so has the majority of the world population, and whether we know it or not. And thank God for all of the wonderful contributions he made, especially in the realm of nonviolence, because the nation of South Africa would not be the same as it is now in terms of lack of troubles, let's just put it that way. And our nation as well owes so much to Dr. King and what he has given us. That in his speeches while I was studying, they just go on and on in wonderful, insightful, beyond his years wisdom that I encourage anyone to study, and everyone, in fact. You know, when you have a free moment, just Google the Nobel Prize speech of Dr. King, or Loving Your Enemies is one of his sermons, and it's just striking and so apt and current and timeless, really. Timeless being the theme this year of the Butler Arts Fest. But with all the stuff, all the bad stuff that goes on in the world, I think you know, I started with Gandhi, and he, of course, not many people do know that he was assassinated himself by usually someone in their own country who is not quite right in their mind, but also too extreme in their views, thinking that we shouldn't have peace, and peace isn't a good thing. And this is all I could really discover from it. But Gandhi, a quote I'd like to read is,
of course,
"When I despair, I remember all through history, the way of truth and love have always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Think of it. Always." So I think, you know, that's an encouraging start. And Gandhi got the principle of nonviolence from reading Tolstoy's extraordinary The Kingdom of God is Within You. And if you can find a good English translation of that, it's a good read as well, which references Jesus' original words, love your enemies. And so this is all flowing through everyone. And even Bobby Kennedy, when he was in South Africa, Cape Town, gave a speech in 1966, you know, 2 years after Nelson Mandela was put in captivity and on Robben Island for 27 years. And so Bobby Kennedy was there saying how we need democracy and so forth in South Africa. And of course, with the minority and majority situation, there was fear. Somehow through this man Mandela, that fear was dispelled. And you know, I kept thinking of, well, we can't have a peacemakers without Jimmy Carter, because he's perhaps the most trusted man in the world, and nations around the world are, you know, have called him since his presidency to come monitor their elections, and he's eradicated diseases that are preventable throughout the world, and has literally improved the lives of millions of people since he's been president of the United States. And those things he was criticized for, like as president, such as the energy policy, trying to find some additional sources of energy, putting you know, the solar panels on the roof of the White House, that sort of thing. And then also his peace in the Middle East call, and all that he put in with the Camp David Accords with Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. I followed this my whole life. It's interested me in addition to music. And in any event, that was the impetus for several of the peacemakers. I could go on, but
so
Matthew's over here too.
All these great ideas and complicated pieces of history and turn it into a concert. And as I said earlier, more than just a concert. I mean, there's all different types of multimedia and elements of performance and narration that's a part of this. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, it's fascinating to go through the score because James has had the very tall task of not only channeling and conveying the message of these individual peacemakers, but obviously creating the music that will go along with it. And it's been, again, a very fascinating process to be a part of this. I was already familiar with three of the excerpts, having conducted them before. But now to see the whole work come together, I mean, there are a lot of moving parts to this. Obviously, there's a video element that's creative to be shown over the orchestra. There are audio samples, including Bobby Kennedy's speech here in Indianapolis after the death of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And the two narrators. We have an encore vocal arts chorus joining us. Indianapolis Children's Choir is here as well, a mezzo-soprano, an American Pianist Association laureate who will be performing with us, Rob Dixon on saxophone. So there's
so excited to
there
see
are
that, yeah.
so many different elements that go into this. And back to James's music with this, there are moments that, for example, the orchestra is prominent, obviously. Whenever the text is present, that is prominent. But there are many examples of when the orchestra just kind of fades back to basically a blanket to support other elements that are going on stage. For example, the Gandhi movement, the strings in the orchestra just sustain a long tone while our sitar player improvises over the top of it. So, you know, James's task here was quite a feat, and he's accomplished it masterfully, adapt each of these different peacemakers with their own history from the country where they come from and their culture, and to incorporate it into a musical tapestry that's just one part of the greater whole.
It sounds like it just must be one of the most complicated performances that the ICO has ever put on.
Well, the great thing about this is that we are in a magnificent concert hall now, the Schrant. It is a first-rate concert hall, which allows us to do all of these things. First of all, the stage is big enough for all of these forces. We have a state-of-the-art facility where all of these multimedia elements can be displayed accurately and easily. And it's comfortable for the audience as well. But the great thing about this is that this has been a project that the Chamber Orchestra has been involved with from the very beginning, the inception of James's idea here. So we do feel like we've kind of been along for this long ride and seen all of this come to culmination.
It must be a wonderful experience for the musicians.
It really is, because they've grown like three excerpts the musicians have already performed. So and James has been wonderful in consulting with them, getting their input on certain things, had the bowings and the violins, for example, and is this technique possible here for the solo viola passage? So they really feel invested in this.
I don't want to single anyone particularly out, because there's a lot of different elements here, but I was very curious to see that Rob Dixon, who's a great jazz player in town, is going to be part of this as well. What is Rob's role in this?
Well, Rob and Dan Tepfer, who is an amazing pianist, also classically trained, and he won the American Pianist Association prize, and he's been playing all over. He's based in New York. He played at Carytown Concert House up in Ann Arbor, lots of places, and a wide variety of ability. But Rob also is so multifaceted in his talent. You know, he studied at IU too, and he worked with David Baker. Anybody who's worked with David Baker, who unfortunately, of course, just passed away, the grand master of wisdom and musical ears. I mean, his hearing was as good as Pierre Boulez, and a wonderful guy too. But Rob's role, Rob and I premiered that section devoted to Martin Luther King at the Bishop Tutu Center, the Peace Learning Center, in January. And it was as a duo. The forces are simply a duo representing Martin Luther King Jr. And I thought the best way to do that would be to actually invoke John Coltrane and McCoy Tyner, two of my heroes when I was growing up, and also throughout. And that style of music you'll see most definitely is influenced for the Martin Luther King tribute. So Rob is a terrific player, and we're glad to have him aboard, and he's enthusiastic about it. And he's also quite involved with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra from time to time.
Yes. I don't normally ask this question, but I am really curious. How long is this piece? I mean, you've brought in the the notation for it, and it's huge. I'm imagining these 9 different sections and everything else. I mean, this is a full evening of performance.
It is the centerpiece of the program, but James can tell you the duration.
Well, the actual duration is 75 minutes of actual music.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not too long. Everybody can put up with an hour and 15 minutes, I hope, and especially with the visual component. And it's all reaching music. I think it's music, you know, that reaches an outstretched hand. I'm not trying to alienate the audience, as composers once did.
James's music, if I can say, is very accessible. And it is, again, in a piece like this, there are moments where the sonorities just swell and obviously have an emotional impact. But I think the real brilliance in this work is how he's been able to fold all of these moving parts into one coherent whole. And we have great aspirations for this piece with the chamber orchestra, that it in these separate modules, mm-hmm. that we can go back and, you know, James can rework some of these for smaller ensembles so that we can use them for educational efforts to take them into the public schools. And obviously a message that's so pertinent in this day and age should be shared with everyone of all ages, not just on a concert night, you know, Friday night at 7:30. But this is I think a work that's going to continue to evolve going forward in how we display it and how we introduce it to new audiences.
That's excellent. And it's obviously an educational piece. I mean, both in terms of the music itself, but also in terms of the subject matter.
Yeah, but we've done it in such a way that when you're watching it and listening, you don't know that. But if we can just point as many people as possible in the direction of further study of all these amazing, brave, you know, incredible peacemakers who knew what they were doing. They weren't naive. They knew they were risking their lives, and some of them actually did, of course, pay the ultimate price. But if we, there's their words, that's what I'm just hoping to push the interested souls out there to follow, you know, in the future by their own further study. But having this also as a college level course, I mean, there's a lot of interdisciplinary courses being offered, you know, on collegiate campuses nationwide. I think this would be perfect. You could teach music, mm-hmm. Classical music, jazz. You can teach world music, you know, music of classical India. And that's not even beginning to talk about the historical aspect of, you know, the 20th century current political situation.
Well,
as
sounds
well
like it's going to be
the whole concept of peace.
Just a great night. Gentlemen, congratulations on bringing this to fruition, and look forward to the Peacemakers concert. Thanks both for being here on Art of the Matter today.
Thank you, Travis.
Thanks again.
Travis DiNicola with the ICO's maestro Matthew Kramer and composer-in-residence James Aikman. Peacemakers will be presented on April 15th at 7:30 at Schrott Center for the Arts at Butler University. And you can find out more at icomusic.org, icomusic.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
For nearly 2 decades, Mark Zelonis served as the Ruth Lilly Deputy Director of Environmental and Historic Preservation for the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Mark has recently retired from that position, and Sharon Gamble invited him in to learn what he's most proud of and what his next chapter is.
Before we talk about your couple of decades, almost 2 decades at the IMA, I want to talk about how you got started on this career path in the first place. When you were growing up, did you know about preservation, conservation?
If I did, it wasn't in that context. It was just sort of what I did and what my dad and my brothers and others did around the house and around the yard. But it was, if I can attribute it to anything, it was probably my father, who of all the 5 sons that he had and 2 daughters, I was the one who spent the most time in the garden, fixing up things around the house, but primarily in the garden. And then some other influence from my grandmother, who, whenever I picked her up to take her to church on Sunday morning, she would take me out into her garden and show me what was in bloom. So it wasn't any direct action on my part. It was just what came to me because that's what I like to do. And then later on when I went to undergraduate school and—
Which was where? Where'd you go?
Northeastern University to start with as a mathematics major.
Oh, really?
And after a year, I said, what in the world am I doing this for? All I could see in my future was teaching, and I really didn't think that was where I should be. So I transferred to the University of New Hampshire, and just by taking an elective course in botany, actually in dendrology or taxonomy, learning the names of plants that were on the campus and in the college woods, I said, boy, this really would be fun. So I sort of changed direction, ended up in what was then called plant science, now called horticulture. But I went through that program and went on my way to do an internship at the Arnold Arboretum in Boston, which was a great first step, and then found my way to the Peace Corps after college.
Did you really?
In Liberia, West Africa, where I met my wife of now 43-plus years.
Wow.
And that gave me a good background in growing things, particularly coffee and cocoa, which is a lot of fun. And from there, the day after I got back from West Africa, I had a call from my former professor saying, boy, there's a job opening at a place called Fuller Gardens in right on the seacoast of New Hampshire, and would you be interested in applying for it? And I did, and I got the job and was there for a good 9 years before deciding to go back to graduate school.
And so that was 9 years was the equivalent of another hands-on degree, really.
It really was, and it was a smallish place, a former estate of Governor Alvin T. Fuller of Massachusetts, back when a governor could live outside the state, live in an adjoining state for his summer months. But it was a great place to learn all the things I needed to learn about not only horticulture, but managing people and budgets and all that sort of thing.
And what the whole not-for-profit world is like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it was just a beautiful place with views of the ocean. We could hear the ocean lapping on the rocks at night. It was just a beautiful spot. So it was tough to pull away and go to graduate school.
What made you decide you needed to go back to school?
I think I needed a bit more training, particularly in management skills and just working with a larger group of people. Fuller Gardens was small enough that it was myself and one other year-round person, but a half a dozen seasonal people that came in for the summer months. And I just thought I needed the chance to work with a larger group of people. So I went to the University of Delaware in its Longwood Graduate Program in Public Horticulture Administration, but also got a Museum Studies Certificate. So I worked with other folks who were in their Museum Studies area to learn all the basic administrative and financial skills that were necessary for a greater position. And when I got through there was a position open at a place in Rhode Island called Blythewold, which is another former private estate turned public, again, right on salt water. So I was very fortunate to have about 1,000 foot long shoreline to deal with 33 acres of spectacular trees and shrubs and plants, but also a historic house, 44 room house that I managed, and just had a great time not only working there, but living there. We lived in the former staff quarters in the mansion.
Oh, fun.
And I was there for 14 years before deciding to come out here to Indiana.
And what appealed to you about this job, this place?
Well, I had, with great fortune, had visited it just a year and a half beforehand. I was asked to come out and address the Horticultural Society at the IMA to give a talk about gardens in New England. I was invited by Chuck Gleaves, who was my predecessor at the IMA. And a year later, when he decided to leave the IMA to go on to Kingwood Center in Ohio, he called and said, gee, would you be interested in taking my place? And if I had not come out here that year before, I probably would not have given it much thought. But I liked what I saw in Indiana. I enjoyed seeing the museum and its gardens. And so within a couple of days, I was out here talking with Brett Waller, who was the director at the time, and was intrigued by not only what was happening there on the property, but what could be happening. We talked about restoring some of the gardens that had not yet been uncovered and restored, but also the Lilly House or Oldfields had a chance to work on that very directly. And then, very importantly, the what is now the Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park,
mm-hmm.
which was really in its very, very rough state back then in the late 1990s.
That had a long gestation then.
A long gestation. It was in Brett's mind for many years as to what could happen out there. And I said, boy, if we can work on this, if we had the funds to do it, we could really make something very significant of it. And luckily, funds did come largely through the Fairbanks Foundation to make it happen. So all of those things made it intriguing to come out and manage an even larger property with a larger staff, and have just grew into it, I think, with the great support of the museum, but in particular the Horticultural Society, which has grown now to be the largest affiliate group of the museum.
I'm very pleased.
It really is. So I'm very happy about that with all the other art venues that could be the largest. But anyway, we're very happy about that. So that group in particular or in general, but also a lot of individuals who gave support, financial and just encouragement over the years to make happen what has happened over the past 18 years or so.
It's a little unusual. I mean, it's not unique, but a little unusual to have an art museum on a campus that had been a private estate.
Right, right. It's a very unusual situation. I don't know of too many, if any, that are exactly like this. The IMA has the great chance to exhibit both that historic landscape that was part of the Oldfields property, but also the new, more contemporary gardens and landscape that are in front of the museum building itself. So there are two very different styles that allow us to present horticulture in many different ways and talk about the changing styles of landscape design. And then with the new Art and Nature Park, you had plants in a very natural setting
mm-hmm.
along the White River. And then most recently, with the addition of the Miller House down in Columbus, with another spectacular landscape by probably one of the most important landscape designers of the 20th century, Dan Kiley.
And it was one of his favorite.
I think it was his favorite. He admitted it was his best work, and it remains his best work. Having seen just about everything that he has designed, it's certainly in the best shape of anything that he worked on for a good 60 years or so. So the museum is really exemplary in having that landscape plus landscapes at the IMA that were done by the Olmsted brothers. There's elements of a Jensen landscape over at the director's residence. And then many other very well-known landscape designers have worked on the museum property. And that's one of the neatest things about having been there. And I know the staff and my new successor, Jonathan Wright, are really in a great position to not only take care of these types of gardens, but to share them with the public.
So take us behind the scenes, because it's one thing to restore a building to how it was when it was built, you know, repairing plaster or tuck pointing or whatever. But a historic landscape, do most landscape architects or designers leave instructions for what's to happen in the future? Because plant materials don't last forever.
Exactly.
So how does that work?
That's a good point. Unfortunately, they don't always leave instructions or a care book. About the only one who did that I know of who was very explicit was Beatrix Farrand, whose probably most famous work is Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C. And she actually
Gorgeous.
Left a manual that said in 15 years these shrubs are going to be at their maturity.
Do this,
take it out, cut it back to the ground or whatever. And that's the only real area or garden that I know of that has been as explicit as that. At the very beginning at the IMA, I had some of our staff people as we were restoring the ravine garden that mm-hmm. With help from the Rapp family, we started to establish a notebook so that whenever anything was replaced or cutbacks, substantially, that was recorded so that whoever takes over in the future will know that in 2002, this was removed and something else put in, and here's the reason why it went from this species or this cultivar to another one. You know, there was problems with its availability or had disease problems, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because that's the other issue. Sometimes, especially if you're dealing with a landscape that was designed decades ago, we might discover that something has all sorts of
issues.
Issues, yeah.
Right. As an example.
It becomes invasive, or it just succumbs to mildew every year or whatever.
Right. Some of the plants that were called for by Percival Gallagher back in 1920 included some honeysuckles, which are either not available now or have become a nuisance in the garden. Barberries were another thing that were just commonly suggested at the time, and we now know that these are not great things to have in the landscape. So we've made some very careful choices, but we've always documented what those choices are so that somebody long after me or my staff would know, okay, that's why they did that. And so we're hoping that people will learn in the future why we did those things.
What a great opportunity to be part of that stewardship.
Oh, yeah. And that's I'm glad you brought that term up, because stewardship is really what this all is. By and large, we did not create that landscape that is there. The newer parts, maybe we had a greater hand in it. But I've always thought that we're stewards along the way. There'll be another group coming in after me and so forth down the line. And it's really a great responsibility to steward that property to the future. And as you know, the landscapes change day by day, even not just month by month, but day by day. And a storm can come in and radically change the landscape, or just over time, things grow and outgrow their spots, and you have to make some changes. So it's important to think of it as a long, long journey.
Not just this lifetime.
Right, right. Yeah. So it's a very slow progressing work of art. It's a work of art in many, many different ways. But the nice thing, and I think for our visitors' sake, is that it does change. Unlike a work of art hanging on a wall, which looks the same now as it did 100 years ago or will 100 years ago or 100 years from now, the landscape is forever changing. And to me, that's the exciting part of it.
Speaking of changing landscapes, what's your next horizon?
My next horizon. Actually, it's since retiring a couple of months ago, I've been as busy as ever with a number of things. Some lecturing, some advisory consulting that I've been doing with a number of groups. In fact, next week I go to New York City for a board meeting for the Library of American Landscape History, on whose board I've been active for about 10 years or so. And this is a group that publishes books on American landscape history, and they have maybe 24 volumes to their credit right now and more in the works, including one on Dan Kiley in the work at the Miller House. So I continue work on that.
You're developing some travel opportunities,
yes,
right?
Yes, travel as well. I've started a new element that at least temporarily is called cultural excursions. And I'm working with a local tour operator, Interlude Tours, and putting together tours around the property, just as I had done for the museum for the past 18 years. And I'm happy to say, as of this morning, our first trip that we're planning to southeastern New England is sold out, starting a wait list for that.
Wow.
And taking suggestions from people as to where they might like to go, either around the country or even overseas. I'm talking with some folks about some possible overseas journeys and things. So it's keeping me busy for sure. And it keeps me active in the field, utilizing my contacts and with colleagues really around the country who know me and are happy to share their properties. That's the nice thing about horticultural folks or people in the historic house business, is they love to showcase what they have. So it occupies a good deal of my time and keeps me in contact with a lot of those folks, but also keeps me in contact with some of the travelers that have been active with me over the past 18 years. So it's just a nice way to keep me involved with them, but also with the world of horticulture and historic preservation in general.
Sharon Gamble with Mark Zelonis, the newly retired Ruth Lilly, Deputy Director of Environmental and Historic Preservation at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. You can learn more about cultural excursions travel at mark.zelonis@att.net. Again, that's mark.zelonis, Z-E-L-O-N-I-S, @att.net. Or you can give a call to 258-2071. Again, 317-258-2071.
Travis?
Yes, Sharon?
I am chalk out of chocolate Easter bunnies.
Oh, no.
So I'm going to have to rely.
We had all the heads and ears and tails.
I know. I'm going to have to rely for more treats on that calendar we call.
What do we do?
What do you have?
Well, I've got some treats for you. Hey, IUPUI's Arts and Humanities Institute has a really interesting series of speakers talking about art and science and the humanities. It's part of their Entanglement series. And they're looking at how have humans reshaped our planet. And they brought in a couple of guest speakers, James Savitsky and Stephanie Kane, for How Do We Remake Our Planet, for a talk April 12th, 7:30 at the Central Library in the Clues Auditorium. It is free and should be really interesting, part of a great series that they're doing at IUPUI.
Wow, I love that. Hey, this Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Indianapolis Hebrew Congregation, there is a free concert by the 65th Street Klezmorim, which will give you an afternoon of lively and great music from one of Europe's oldest musical traditions, and you'll get a sneak peek of what they'll be playing at the Great Chicago Jewish Festival in June. So this Sunday, 2 o'clock, IHC, 65th Street, Klezmorim.
The Diva Fest continues on this weekend at Indie Fringe. That's right. Plays by 12 different really fascinating women who are writing some really interesting, fun short plays that are part of the Fringe. Diva Fest goes on this weekend.
The Central Indiana Community Foundation wants you to dream big about what Indianapolis will be like 100 years from now. They've launched a project called the Ben Franklin Funds. If you go to your search engine and type in Indianapolis Ben Franklin Funds, you can find out lots more about that.
And just a reminder that the Chris Morehouse Guild Book and Author Benefit Luncheon is coming up April 15th. Starts at 10 o'clock, and there's six distinguished authors who will be reading and signing their books there. And it's just a great luncheon program and a fundraiser for the Chris Morehouse.
Fantastic.
Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, indeed. Hey, don't forget you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. And you can send us your chocolate bunnies and listen to us on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Author Pete Ferry's stories have appeared in McSweeney's, Chicago Quarterly Review, and Story Quarterly. He's written two novels, Travel Writing, which was published in 2008 to international acclaim, and Old Heart, which was published in June of 2015 and has been named the Chicago Writers Association Book of the Year. Travis DiNicola spoke with Ferry about his work.
Pete, welcome to Art of the Matter. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you, Travis.
I'm looking forward to meeting you and talking with you about your work. First off, congratulations on Old Heart being named the Chicago Writers Association Book of the Year last year. That's a pretty big honor.
Thank you. I was delighted.
Yeah. What does that mean? How did that come about?
Well, I think it's probably the most prestigious literary award in Chicago, maybe the only one. So makes it the least prestigious, too. But Chicago Writers Association is mm-hmm. a respected outfit, and they review all the books that written in,
so
in
the
Chicago
who,
or by Chicago writers.
Your peers who selected you for
yeah,
this?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a great honor.
It is.
It is.
I was delighted. Yeah.
Now, you've been living and writing in Chicago for quite a long time. We're going to talk about Old Heart in just a minute. But before we do, I do want to talk about some of your other work. You're also a travel writer as well as writing short stories and have been in some great publications like McSweeney's. And,
yeah.
Tell me a bit about your background, your history here.
I'm a high school teacher. I taught for 27 years at Lake Forest High School, north of Chicago. And, you know, like most English teachers, I wanted to be a writer all along.
Of course.
I've written for the Tribune travel section for about 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And but I published my first novel in 2008 as a result of having been invited to teach creative writing for the first time. And thought I should do a little bit of that.
And that novel is travel writing, right?
It's called Travel Writing.
So I see how you worked in your travel writing work into your novel, fiction work as well. It's a nice blending there.
Yeah.
So with your newer piece, with the one that came out last year, Old Heart, there's some travel elements in that as well, of course. Tell me a bit about this book, because it's a story of an older man who's trying to connect back to his past and doing so in some interesting ways, and it's basically sort of told through the eyes of his granddaughter as well.
That's correct. Yeah, I was a Fulbright, took part in the Fulbright Teaching Exchange Program way back in 1991 and 92, and I lived for a year in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And then a teacher from there, and I have started a student exchange, which we did for 20 years, and it's still going on. I'm no longer involved. Between her high school and my high school. So I've spent a lot of time in the Netherlands, and I've really come to love it. So
sure,
the story is set in part in the Netherlands. The fact that the main character is 85, he's also 26 for half the book, or a good part of the book, because it's the basis of this novel is human relationships, and all of them. You know, at its heart is a love story, actually two love stories between the same two people, but 60 years apart. When they were young in World War II, and then at the end of their lives when he goes to see if he can find the only woman he ever truly loved after a long life and a not very successful marriage. So it's a novel about family relationships, about the relationships of parents with children, but also children with parents as the parents age. It's a story about a relationship between a father and a son who has Down syndrome, and about a bad marriage, about a good relationship, and how we survive all those things. How, you know, despite life's roadblocks, we find our own happiness somehow.
It seems that he was really your main character, kind of treading water for quite a long time in his marriage with his family, taking care of the responsibilities that he had committed to, but always sort of longing for something else, and this woman that he had met in the Netherlands. And, you know, 85 is an advanced age to go back on an adventure like that, and his kids are very resistant to it.
They are, as well they should be, probably, as I would be, I think. But, you know, at one point he asked the question, what do I, you know, when he's finally free of all his obligations, what do I do with the rest of my life? And he doesn't know the answer until he asks the next question, which is, do I do something or do I do nothing? And then it's easy. He decides to do something. And I suppose he's my alter ego to the degree that I would like to think I would answer the question the same way. I'm not sure I'd have the guts to, but.
Of course, the one exception in his family is his granddaughter, who is supportive.
Yeah.
I mean, she sort of recognizes the romance, the adventure, the need for this.
Yeah, as I think sometimes happens with grandchildren and grandparents. I think there can be some special bonds there. But she, in many ways, is the character. She's a character who evolved over time. She began as a kind of device, a means by which he could find out what's going on at home and at the same time keep in touch. Through her, and then she just kept evolving and asserting herself as characters. You know, I would find a place I'd say, well, oh, gee, this is a place Nora could provide this information. This is a place we could hear Nora's voice. And I came to realize that in many ways she's a main character, if not the main character, in the sense that she's the character on whom the story acts.
Yes.
She's the character who's probably most changed by the action of the story.
Let me ask you this. something that I'm very curious about because of your background also as a travel writer.
Mm-hmm.
And some authors really rely on location as sort of the base for their work. Do you find that because you have that background as a travel writer, does that make that part easier for you to sort of be able to lay down this foundation of place that you can then overlap your characters onto? Or how do you think about that?
I don't think I have thought about that. That's a heck of a good question.
Well, let's talk about it.
All right.
Okay.
I think the answer to that is that it's sometimes easier to look at the place that is not your home than the place that is your home. Mm-hmm. And very often, I think I've lived abroad twice in my life, each time for a year, and I've learned a whole heck of a lot about the places I've lived, the Netherlands and Mexico. But I've also learned a lot and maybe more about my home by being there and looking back.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's easier to write about a different place. And maybe you're writing about your home, even if you're not.
Were you able to get back to the Netherlands at all to do any research while you were working on this?
Oh, yeah. I go all the time. I just came back. I just came back in January.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Because of this teaching exchange program that we established, I've made a lot of friends there.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a big book signing in The Hague when I was there. I go there as often as I can. I love it.
I guess one thing I was sort of thinking is it almost, I would imagine, it makes it a little easier since you're so familiar with the place, with the Netherlands, and with your experience as a travel writer, that you can really sort of focus your creative energies on the development of these characters in some ways.
Perhaps. Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's true. But it's also fun to put them in a different context and deal with the cultural stuff that is different there.
And have them visit places that you know very dearly.
And interact with the Dutch and all their eccentric and wonderful and strange ways. And
sure, of course.
An opportunity for humor. And
not just the place, but the people there.
Yeah. And I really wanted to pick Tom up and put him somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want him, you know, to go from northern Illinois to southern Michigan or to central Indiana. I wanted him to go someplace else.
Someplace that really challenges him
as far as who he is. And, you know, someplace where he can't just get on a train and be home in a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
Someplace that is, but also a place with which he has a connection because he was there during the war,
sure.
World War II.
Though obviously it's very different now.
Very different.
Is there any, I don't know, I suppose sort of like a, you may call it an Easter egg or something that's sort of tucked in the book, a little special place or location or memory of an encounter with, you know, someone you knew there that you kind
of
worked
including
into the
names.
Book. Yeah.
I've used the names of people I know with their permission, of Dutch people, throughout. And, you know, those are little Easter eggs, but also the places, to be sure.
Sure, of
Veldhoven
course.
Is the place I lived, and it's the place that Tom lived and has returned to. I've rearranged it. I've made it a different size so that he can get around a little bit more easily at his age. I've taken some liberties with it, but it's essentially the place, and it's the spirit of the place. I actually went back there in January again for a big celebration of the town. They invited me and a couple other people to talk about our experiences there, and it was a radio presentation, and with a full audience, it was great fun.
So, has this been translated into Dutch at all, or is there a plan for that? Or?
Some early chapters have been, and we're still working on it. I did meet with Dutch publishers while I was there, but that hasn't come to pass yet. That's kind of a slow process,
sure,
or maybe no process, but. Not yet. I'm hoping.
So
I have had a nice reception. You know, everyone in the Netherlands speaks English and reads English. So a lot of people have read it. And I've been I kind of held my breath that Dutch people would say, that's not us. But they haven't. They've enjoyed
it. But so far it's been good?
So far.
So far the reception's been good. Now, when you're at Indie Reads Books, you'll be reading some from it?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's just come by and, you know, have a glass of wine and sign and say hello. And I'm not planning anything. I don't think I'm going to read.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
That's okay. Either way.
Yeah.
Let me ask you what you're working on now. Is it do you have something else in the works then, or some location you want to be writing about?
I'm writing a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called The Big Potato, as in the opposite of the, you know, small potatoes.
Uh-huh.
And I just my wife just finished reading it yesterday and she tells me I have a lot of work to do. So it's, as usual, it's going to be a long process.
Can you tell us where it's set?
Well, The Big Potato is set in what I call Stevenson County,
mm-hmm.
Illinois, which is a really lake county, Illinois, the suburban county north of Chicago, in and around Chicago. In
that near area. Potato farming land?
No, okay. Not really.
Well, very good. Well, we're looking forward to reading that one as well when that's completed. And you take your wife's notes on that?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today. And looking forward to seeing you at Indie Reads Books and talking about, of course, Old Heart. Thank you very much, Pete.
Thank you, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with author Peter Ferry. Ferry will be reading from his novel Old Heart at Indie Reads Books on Sunday, April 10th from 2 to 4 p.m. And you can learn more about him at peterferrywrites.com, PETERFERRY writes.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of an art show that benefits undocumented youth.
I'll find out about what the University of Indianapolis Theater Program has planned for the spring.
And I'll go on an urban adventure with the Arts Council's celebration of the Indy 500, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.